The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hi, everybody, and good evening here from Finland. We are working now with our Dissipation of Glamour broadcast. So far, there is the intention to broadcast the Soul of Nations tomorrow and the Attracting Money for Hierarchical Purposes on the next night, Sunday. We'll see whether I carry through on that exactly, because there's so many Gemini full moon activities going on right now. Also tonight at 11 o'clock, well, it's 11 o'clock my time, PM, the 8 o'clock GMT, and maybe Michael or BL, we could get that link in. There's going to be the keynote webinar for the keynote of resurrection, the second day keynote. Yesterday it was the hierarchical love, and today resurrection, and tomorrow contact. All of these at 8 PM GMT. Hopefully you've received the notification, a somewhat modified notification about all this. And then the next night, which would be Sunday night, we'll have our pre-full moon broadcast, and followed by later the next day, the actual Gemini full moon. It will be not a webinar, as all of these have been. I'm sorry if I called it a broadcast. All of these have been webinars, but on Monday morning at 7 GMT a.m., we will be doing a little broadcast on the Gemini full moon. Also, it is my intention, I'm still trying to decide whether at approximately 10 at night, GMT on Sunday night, I'll be beginning again an offering on Identify as Being. From the Identify as Being group, you know, we're working on the philosophy of being, and we've already gone through two sections of that, and this will be a longer one, and hopefully will last a number of years, because we are going to be going through the book that I'm writing, and as I write it, I'm going to submit it to you, and you can work with it just as I will be working with it, because it is meant to be a practical book. So let's see, the first thing I want to do then is have a little alignment here for us. Wherever we may be geographically, we try to come in spiritual contact with each other. The group soul, and also all of us reaching out as soul-infusing personalities to each other. And so really, you know, we're overcoming the spatial factor and moving gradually towards this factor of omnipresence. Next will come omniscience, then will come omnipotence, you know, as the higher initiations proceed. And of course, these will have to be interpreted in planetary terms and not in terms of the whole solar system and beyond. So we will work together in the same space in consciousness as we work with this. I think, you know, we've been circulating around these glamours of mistaken identity, really. We'll deal, I think, with selfishness tonight, because it's all a question of a wrong assessment of what we are, and then the attempt to feed that aspect of ourselves which is not the real human being. So all around us, you know, the battle between selfishness and selflessness, Arjuna faced this on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. It's a battle, in a way, between, symbolically speaking, between the sun and the moon, but more this battle also has certain occult factors which correlate with the sun and with the moon. So I'd just like to welcome those who have come along for this meditation. We've had to do some revision, and glad you were able to make it here. Just want to welcome you, Anne-Marie, Antoinette, Carl, Dana, Deborah, Diana, George, Jillian, Joan, Karen, Karen Gritzka, and Karen Johansson, and Karim Joy, Marion, that says Marion Karim Joy, Catherine, Lenny, Leslie, Margot, Mariut, Martha, Gallagher, and Martha Mickelson, Michael, Nienke, Risto, Sam, Stacia, Tia, and let's see, and Anne Veronica. And backing us up on the staff side, we have Michael, Stacy, and B.L. Allison. So I think we're ready to go. And we'll always begin a little bit with the reading from the book, Glamour, A World Problem. Okay. My telephone has a way of wanting to interrupt. So we're beginning with our 114th program, and our academic reading is number 54, and we're on page 101. We've been going through these various types of conflict, a conflict that occurs on the physical plane, where the etheric and the physical plane are struggling in this question of purification. And then through the Arjuna experience on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, which has more to do with the emotional plane. And I think there are so many people today that are precisely at that level where they have to choose between familiar forces in their energy system. You know, which side of the family will win this battle? Well, there was some millions of years ago a great battle that took place, they say, on the plains south of what is now the Indian city of Delhi. And it was a tremendous battle and decisive in the Atlantean War. So we have that Atlantean War, many of us raging within our nature, and which will determine a true orientation and the ability to overcome selfishness, you know. Selfishness is a factor much associated with the non-sacred planet Mars, which is less developed than our own Earth, actually. You know, it's the cross above the circle. It's one of the symbols of Mars. And when we come to our Earth, it's the cross already within the circle, encircled, the encircled cross. And eventually Venus supervenes and the circle rises above the cross. So this is the battle with selfishness and self-interest. We see it going on all over the world. People just can't raise their sights beyond what we might call the obvious man. You know, the man, the human being we think we are, because it seems so close to us. And then we miss the human being we really are, the interior human being, and we all have to have that sense of being the inner individual and ultimately what the Tibetan calls the God within. So in this Arjuna experience, first of all, Arjuna is bewildered. He doesn't know where to throw his strength. and he becomes depressed, and he broods there in his chariot. And then Krishna, the soul, advises him, and eventually Arjuna begins to awaken. And he becomes the recognition, into the stage of the recognition of his own release, how he is to do that. The form of God in the Bhagavad Gita is revealed to him. It's one of those beautiful sections in the Bhagavad Gita. It really is a very unitive, inclusive section. And then he's advised to let the soul within him, the inner warrior, carry on the fight. I think a lot of fourth-rate people, they'll be coming into incarnation, and they'll know a lot about turning the battle over to the inner warrior. And in each case, even now, even if we're not a fourth-rate soul, that inner warrior is the soul. And so they will then, when right decision and choice have been made, stand up and fight. And the Tibetans often said, well, see that you battle, he said. Well, that's the battle without and the battle within. And such people who do prevail, and let us be among them, will find themselves no longer on the path of purification, but finally on the path of discipleship. The path of purification is ruled by two rays, which have a lot to do with the battle and the warrior, ray 4 and 6. Those are the rays governing the path of aspiration and purification. By the time we get to true discipleship, we switch into a mental focus, and rays 3 and 5 in general govern. And when we finally enter the true path of initiation, maybe it's as we approach the third degree, it's the first ray and the seventh ray that govern. And in general, the second ray is the inclusive ray supervising all of this progress. So that's a little bit about the background of where we have been. And now we take up the third stage. And we have the intelligent thinking man, which means that he is fit, it appears, finally, to be a disciple, and he's working very much with the mental rays. You know, when we talk about discipleship, sometimes you think, well, what DK really means here is the accepted disciple. And somewhere between the first and second initiation, and maybe closer to the second, the opportunity to tread the path of accepted discipleship is presented. And I think we're going to have to go over that at some point. I think we're going to have a kind of webinar series on the six stages of discipleship. And actually, there's a seventh as well, because we're all passing through that, aren't we? And it'd be very good to know where we stand and what we have to do. So we enter now the stage wherein the intelligent thinking man, whether the disciple or well-meaning aspirant, you know, the aspirant can't quite hold with the will and the mind, you know, so rightly oriented but weak, or the initiate of the first and second degree, they're all, you know, sort of put together, has to learn to distinguish between the truth and the many truths, between knowledge, and wisdom. We have the experience of pursuing a lot of knowledge, and certainly Master DK is one of the masters that helps us do that. But out of the many examples of knowledge, has to be distilled something that will work all the time, and which will help us use knowledge to lead us to our goal, and that is wisdom. So, you know, these questions of discrimination are so vitally important. We know that the power of discrimination is found exactly at the midway point on the mental plane. That's the power, or the city, that is going to lead us into the higher mental plane and into the realm of the soul. And I think it's fair to say that most of us have a lot of work to do yet with being able to discriminate. So we distinguish between the big truth and the many lesser truths, between knowledge and wisdom, and in this case, between reality and illusion. The intelligent thinking man, at first, is certainly subject to illusion, which is sort of a mental misinterpretation of the truth. The word illusion is used in so many different ways. In a certain sense, the whole universe is the great illusion, the great Mahamaya. But of course, we're trying to be much more practical than that and get down onto the level of the right use of the mind or its incorrect use and misinterpretation. So this is the third stage in the battle against glamour here. And when this stage has been passed through, it leads to the third initiation, wherein the personality, which on its own is prone to Maya, etheric, physical, glamour, emotional, and illusion mental, stands free. The freeing of the personality from the ancient authority of the lunar lords. Now, we have to judge whether we have really reached this degree of freedom yet, or whether we're on our way, or whether we're in the midst of a battle. You know, it helps to know where one stands. So, the personality will again experience a sense of at-one-ment. And that at-one-ment is due to the development of the sense of intuition, which puts into the disciple's hand an infallible instrument whereby to discriminate and to discern. So intuition is one of those unitive factors, and Master Moria calls it straight knowledge. So here it is on the fourth subplane, and we learn increasingly to use the intuition, the Christ force, the pure reason, the middle section of the spiritual triad to create a sense of pervasive unity of the right kind in our lives. So we're able, you know, instead of reasoning about a thing, and it's good to reason, it's good to use the mind in a logical manner, but instead of having to do that, something, you know, along with Saturn, which with Mercury gives a sense of logical sequence, suddenly under Uranus, under Neptune, the immediate answer comes. It's not so much a psychic hunch, he tells us, but the revelation of that which is truly real. So our perception, you know, intuitive perception, is connected with the initiative of the third degree. Its perception is becoming accurate. His perception is becoming accurate. And he stands, to the benefit of being careful, relatively free, relatively, from deception and wrong identifications and wrong interpretation. So obviously, I think if we're honest, we'll realize that we are working towards this state of relative freedom, and the work of building the Antikorana, which can connect us with the spiritual triad, is very necessary as we are attempting to do this, you know, to become just more accurate and more wise and more seeing with respect to our discipleship understanding and our discipleship service. So, you will have noted, says the Tibetan, how the career of the man has therefore proceeded from a crisis of duality. The wretched aspirant warring, you know, the fighter with duality found in the middle phase of Scorpio, because we are a scorpionic hierarchy. We human monads are somehow essentially ruled by Scorpio, even though Gemini and Leo have had so much to do with our individualization. It's a battle for us all the way. We've been, all of this stage now has been proceeded from a crisis of duality to one of relative unity, and the more buddhi enters the causal body, the more the perception of the unity of things is revealed to us. Eventually oneness will be revealed to us, and that's even beyond unity. Now, we go through these various stages only to have that sense of unification disturbed by a renewed recognition of a higher and deeper duality. There's a duality between soul and personality, and there's a higher duality between the spiritual triad and the soul-infused personality. And then we might even say the monad enters into the task later and is one of the dual factors, with the entire lower man being its opposite. So cleavages from cleavage, you know how it goes, to unity, to cleavage, to unity. You know the sense of that serpent, the two serpents rising, and every time they cross, there's a phase of unity, which is temporary, and then they split again, and we have the duality. So this duality temporarily produces another cleavage in the man's life, and thus reinitiates a torturing process of bridging, or of occultly healing this break in the continuity of spiritual consciousness. And there's a lot about here, the building of the Antikarana. That's where the break really has occurred. And we are, for the most part, until we are a more advanced disciple, we're cut off from that which the spiritual triad can reveal. But when we work around the time of the second initiation with Mercury, with Scorpio, etc., we will have the ability to make this bridge between the monad triad and the soul personality. Okay, I'm just trying to see if I can, everything looks okay here. Sometimes my spell checker doesn't work, or it just gives up because there's so many strange words that it says, okay, over to you. I would here remind you that this sense of peace or perception of cleavage is in itself an illusion and of the nature of glamour. Now that's interesting. And is based on the illusory sense of identification with which is not the self, with that which is not the self or soul. So have we asked ourselves, with what are we really identified? Where is our point of identification? What point of tension are we holding? What point of tension are we holding? And with what factor in our energy system, higher or lower, are we fixated? What do we think we are? What do we know we are? So many difficulties arise because of mistaken identity. We simply think we are what we are not, and we dedicate our energies to preserving and seeing the prospering of that which we are not, and so we miss the point. He says, the entire problem can be solved if the shift of the consciousness is away from identification with the lower forms of experience into that of identification with the real true man. And you know, think about it, isn't this what the Buddha tried to have us accomplish and still tries to have us accomplish as he trains us for, as his teaching at least, trains us for accepted discipleship. It's part of the old system in India, not this, not that, not this, not that, one after another, we rebuke or repudiate the fields of form and energy with which we had identified, and we then solve our problem. So if we're attached to the lower 18 subplanes, or what we might call the dense physical body of our planetary logos, we are contradicting what the Buddha would have us do. We have to rise out of material identification. Okay, so we move on to the fourth point. We've had that battle on the etheric physical area, and we've had our Arjuna fighting it out on the astral plane, and we've had this mental application so that we no longer misinterpret so frequently and become increasingly free of illusion. And now stage four here. I think it looks like a summary a bit. Stage by stage, the man has progressed from one state of illusion or glamour to another. You know, let's just say, we can say, whoopsie, always an illusion or glamour less dense. That's the idea. From one point of discriminative opportunity to another, until he has developed in himself three major capacities. So let's see, are we possessed of these, or are we working on them? Do we recognize that we are actually engaged in cultivating these? So number one, the capacity to handle force. I think when, you know, from esoteric astrology, when Saturn steps into the picture, and we can decide in an intelligent manner, then we are no longer driven up and down the land, as the old commentary tells us. And instead of being driven by the forces, we handle them. Also, the capacity to tread the middle way between the pairs of opposites. And you can think of the pairs of opposites as a vertical. And let's just say always a balanced position, not too much of the material element and not too much of the otherworldly element, but keeping the balance between. That's kind of a Libran way to tread the path. And Libra oftentimes indicates the beginning of treading the path. And finally, something that I don't think that any of us have fully developed yet, because it comes much more solidly in with the fourth initiation, the capacity to use the intuition. Let's just say coming in more fully with the fourth initiation. So let's see what we have here, stage by stage. And we develop three major capacities. And I dare say, oh, we're working, you know, pretty much on the second and third here. These capacities he developed by resolving the pairs of opposites on the physical, astral, and lower mental planes. You know, in white magic, you have to choose the correct path. That's maybe a little bit more, well, it can be vertical, it can be horizontal. You don't want to tread the way of dense form when you have the chance to tread the way of the etheric vehicle filled with higher forces. You don't want negative selfish emotion when you can have the higher and positive aspiration and emotions of the higher astral plane. And you don't want only concrete mentality, but you want to be fed somewhat by the higher mind. And we students of Alice Bailey and the Tibetan are certainly, is one of our major first things we do. We are fed by the energies coming in on the higher, from the higher mind. These capacities he developed by resolving these pairs of opposites. And so, you know, one of them becomes superior and one becomes, the other becomes the instrument. Now he faces his climaxing resolution. In other words, he's etherically governed. He's governed by a higher aspiration instead of lower desire. He's governed by the a higher mind rather than the lower. And here comes a climaxing resolution equipped with these powers. He becomes aware, as St. Paul was very much aware, you know, but he was, of course, starting out as a pretty high initiate and making a tremendous fiery progress towards the fourth initiation. He becomes aware of those two great and apparently opposing entities, which, with both of whom he finds himself consciously identified, the angel of the presence and the dweller on the threshold. There's so much glamour surrounding these particular ideas, but basically we're talking about the well-equipped personality, which may be, however, selfish, and we're talking about the sense of the causal body of the egoic lotus and of the higher power and the sort of solar angel functioning as the angel of the presence on the higher mental plane. So that, you know, that battle really, finally, will be decided at the fourth initiation. And DK, interestingly, takes us even beyond the fourth initiation, mentioning the dweller and the angel. Behind the angel, because it's called of the presence, right? Behind the angel, he dimly senses not another duality, but a great identity, a living unity, which for lack of a better word, we call the presence. And this is the monad, as it were, behind the angel of the presence. Okay, and the angel of the presence, how do we define it? I define it as much of the solar angel as can be transferred into the higher mental plane and create a vehicle for man on the higher mental plane. The entirety of the solar angel cannot operate on the higher part of the mental plane. It would just be too much, and it would be destructive. So the old saying applies, having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. And that's what the solar angel is saying when it creates this angel of the presence. So somehow the monad is coming into cognizance. And I oftentimes say, well, you know, the monad, how do we define that? In the new book I'm writing, I'm trying to get into that quite a bit. But let's just say it's a whole lot more than a dot on a page, you know. It's a type of expansive awareness with simultaneous identification, which not only sees and feels the unity of things, but which sees and feels and identifies as the oneness of things. So, you know, from unity to oneness, you know, from division and battle, all that, into an achieved unity, into an achieved oneness. So behind the angel of the presence, he dimly senses the presence, and the angel will, in a way, stand by and stand back and introduce him to the presence. I don't have time to go over it right now, but if you go into those seven paragraphs in Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, about the angel of the presence, read the fifth one. And the fifth paragraph gives you a marvelous understanding about how the angel of the presence, the man, and the monad, or presence, all work together. Okay, so let's go on a little bit more. We've been through a lot of battles, and the monad is coming into sight. And you know, astrologically, if you're ready for that stage of recognition, you look at your astrological chart, you've got a triangle there. And that triangle is formed between the sun, the ascendant, and the point opposite the sun. So it's particularly as DK has revealed to us, the point opposite the sun, which is revealing the way in a particular life the monad can be operating. The effect of the solar angel is coming in at the ascendant, and the effect of the personality is coming in where the sun sign is found. It's a great simplification in astrology, which is such a complex way of approaching understanding. And this simplification is available to all sincere students as they simply study that particular triangle. Of course, the mistake would be if they think they're necessarily ready for a monadic revelation, and they're not. But all of us can be ready for the revelation of the ascendant, which is meant to take us closer to the center of our life and make soul reception a greater possibility. Okay, behind the angel, he dimly senses not another duality, but a great identity. Of course, it really is himself, really, a living unity. Notice the first and second aspects involved there, which, for lack of a better word, we call the presence. And if we can, you know, it's an old, maybe a Jesuit practice, the practice of the presence of God. If we can look around us at all forms and somehow with an open heart and maybe an opening heart in the head, sense some living uniformity within all of these different perceptions of form, maybe we're getting a little idea of this presence of God. It's not going to be the, you know, the presence of the old white man with the long beard sitting on a cloud and all that. It's going to be a living sense of oneness, which somehow underlies all diversity. So he then discovers that the way out, because we're always, you know, it's going to be a long time, every time you get plunged into a universe and become some kind of emanation temporarily, you have to retrace your steps and find the way out and through. So he then discovers that the way out, in his case, is not the method of handling force, which is still important, of course, or of leaving both of the pairs of opposites, leaving behind both of the pairs of opposites, though it's true that if we tread the path of the Shishumna, in a way we are somehow uniting the left and the right, the Ida and Pingala, or of the right recognition through the intuition, which would be a dispelling illusion, but that the dweller and this angel must be brought together. You know, these are really important statements here by the Tibetan, and they're going to require of us some significant pondering. In other words, we've worked on the etheric physical plane, we've worked on the astral plane, we've worked on the mental plane, but now there's something else operating. The dweller and the angel must be brought together, and the dweller, which is once purified, is not a bad thing. It's the instrument of the angel. It is the well-accomplished personality which, without sufficient spiritual vision, can stand as an obstacle to the greater revelation. But for people like ourselves who study occultism carefully and the Tibetan carefully, it will not be that. The dweller will be a useful instrument. The lower entity, the old man, shall we say, the waning twin of Gemini, must be, in a selfish sense, blotted out in the light or forced to disappear within the radiance. I sometimes tell the story. I had an aunt who was a great aficionado of photography, and it was 50 years ago at Thanksgiving, and I was looking at the television, and she wanted to take a picture of the family, so she turned on the floodlights so she could use them with her camera, and immediately the image on the screen disappeared. The lesser light was blotted out in the radiance of the greater light. It made such an impression upon me. I was just beginning to study, you know, with the Arcane School, and it was a long time ago, but it was a material lesson about how you can focus on a lesser light, but a greater light will blot it out. Okay, so the lower entity must be blotted out in the light. He must increase and I must decrease, said John the Baptist, who, by the way, the Tibetan tells us, was working through and with the sign Gemini. But I'll just bet that one of his other prominent signs was a water sign like Pisces. So, or forced to disappear within the radiance. The greater light prevails and the lesser light fades, wanes, as they say. This is the task of the higher of the two entities, which with which the disciple or the initiate consciously and deliberately identifies himself. And with this process we'll later deal. And so we identify, IDFY, maybe IDF, identify as Castor, no, as Pollux, and relinquish Castor. And you know what's interesting about Castor? Castor is not just one star. Castor is three pairs of stars. So basically six stars, and they must fade, as it were. You know, usually when you're reading the star manuals, things are so much easier when you're under the influence of Castor rather than Pollux, but that's because it's more suited to the personality and less challenging of the personality. There's a lot we can, he said that, you know, the disciples should study the star lore and the presence of certain stars, significant stars in their horoscope. So, you know, basically when you're looking at the map, you've got the one great logoic plane, and you have three other pairs, six other planes. Sometimes it goes one and six, and sometimes it goes one, two, and then five. You know, there's different ways of dividing these planes to reveal significance. But anyway, we have to learn how to get a grip on our lower six, as it were, the Castor part of ourself. That must wane finally, and Pollux must shine forth. So this is the problem of which faces the initiate before he takes the final three initiations. And what are they? What are they? Not sure here, but five, six, seven, maybe something like that. Anyway, on our planet, it's fair to say that the fifth initiation can be taken. And also the sixth and seventh. But when you get to the eighth and ninth, and are they included in this? It's better to take them on other planets, or maybe easier. And all of this information, very occult information, is given in that early book, Initiation, Human, and Solar. So never shun or dismiss the early books, because they may be holding exactly that piece of information which you need. Now it says, you must bear in mind that none of these three stages are in reality divided off from each other by clear lines of demarcation, nor do they follow each other in clear sequence. And this is such an important sentence about development in general. It's not just, you know, going along the railroad track, one intersection after another. There's all kinds of development occurring, maybe a little bit ahead, a little bit behind. Sometimes, for instance, in the egoic lotus, we develop a petal in the next tier of petals, next circle of petals, when we have not even developed all of the petals in the previous tier. So the whole idea of the sequence of our development has a lot to do with our monadic ray, with our past, I would say, and with our environment. It's not just a cut and dried process. Just, you know, I think the early theosophists sometimes made a little bit of a mistake there when they were describing rounds and globes and chains. It was as if such a regular and invariable process as they described it, so utterly sequential. But then they were using the concrete mind very much, and that's the way the concrete mind often reveals things. In fact, it's much more organic, shall we say, and the unfolding of a flower has a lot of the overlaps going on. Oh, yeah, okay, so they proceed with much overlapping and often with a partial simultaneity. It is only when the disciple faces certain initiations that he awakens to the fact of these distinctions. Now, let's see. I have a feeling that, let's see. Well, this is actually, this is so important that I'm not going to go ahead with it right now. I'm going to, what I'm going to do is make this the breaking point. And I'll go back here and see if I can, I think we'll meet again next week. Like I say, to you right now is at the Arcane School Conference in London. I think it's very important that we do our best to bridge with the various esoteric groups. And there's going to be a time towards the end of the month when neither she nor I will be able to carry on for about 1 week this series of programs, but we will let you know. You know, we'll do our best. We try to stay as constantly with it as we possibly can, and it's not always possible, but sometimes it is possible. So this will be the end, and what we've experienced right now is the end of number 114, and today is the 14th, and I don't know how far we've gone. What is the, what page are we on? We never, you know, do a lot of pages, but we're on page 103. Is that right, Michael?
I think page 103 is correct.
Okay, very good. All right. The divine mathematician stays ever alert. All right. So we've gotten up to page 103, and we've gone, I think, from 101 to 103. All right, then we're going to begin number 119, or 115 next time. It'll be academic reading number 55. I like that number 55. I think in numerology it sums to the name of Sanat, which is important. And we have our summer solstice coming up here, so we'll be doing something there as well. And, you know, lots to keep us, I think, very busy. So we'll be talking about the dweller on the threshold and the angel of the presence in five different stages when we meet again the next time. And it will be a morning meeting, I guess, on Friday. Will that be it? And it's on the 21st. All right. Right. It's a Friday. Very good. Okay, good. All right, friends. Now, it's interesting material, and we want to be able to apply it to our lives. We are working our way through the triple threat of Maya, glamour, and illusion, and we meet this triple threat all the time. You know, I think maybe it's Antaeus, and we meet Geryon in the 12th labor of Hercules, and we, of course, meet the Hydra, which is a triple being, really a ninefold being, but principally a triple being. And we are threatened with the veiling of reality in all three aspects of our personality nature, which we have to transform and bring greater lucidity into. And so at first we become, transparent is the last, you're translucent, yeah. Well, right now we're opaque. A lot of us have these moments of opacity, and the light just doesn't get through. Then the light starts to come through, and we develop our translucent vehicles, and finally we develop transparent vehicles. And sometimes DK says, you know, don't worry so much about all the details, just become transparent in your personality, and much will be taken care of. Okay, so now I open it up to you, and maybe you've been taking some notes, something of interest to you, something you'd like to state or question. And if there is anything along that line, then I'll do my best to offer some thoughts. You know, never saying that I know the answer. It's a long way before we become a master, and a master will surely tell you how very little he knows compared to what can be known. So are there any thoughts or any questions along the lines that we have been studying today? Okay, we've moved into the fourth stage. We have developed the intuition, and now we're going to put together the fifth stage, which is the merging of the dweller on the threshold with the angel of the presence, the angel being, as I've been trying to get across, as much of the angel of the presence as can be encapsulated, tolerated, housed, whatever, within the causal body or egoic lotus. We've got to pay a lot more attention to the development that's going on for us and within us on the higher mental plane, because our days of personality consuming personality interest, I say, should be coming rapidly to an end. And the way you know that is that you start to transfer onto the fixed cross, and you're transitional from the mutable cross. Maybe Pisces is prominent. You transfer onto the fixed cross and begin to undergo that series of early initiations, which will take you into the fifth kingdom of nature. Okay, anything, friends? Anything at all? Anything? Any? Are you struck by any thought? If you are, just raise your hand or write something out in the, I think the chat box gives you a chance as you ask questions or whatever. You know, we're studying along. We're doing what those early disciples did 90 years ago. Section after section, DK wrote about glamour. And as he wrote, he released what he wrote to the students. And then at the end of the whole thing, he collected the many things he had written in these sequential presentations and made a book out of it. So we're helping as best we can behind the scenes to learn as they learned and to meditate together as they meditated, and hopefully with some degree of success in this very troubled world. Is there anything you would like to know, or you would like to deal with, or in general in occultism, that you would like to discuss? And you know, the floor is open. Okay, and if not, aha, okay. So here's Catherine Swenson. I did a quick search on force and energy and found something interesting and healing. Well, generally, you know, EH 583, in general, there is a kind of division between force and energy, where as forces are directed and apply to the lower of the duality, to the personality in general, and energies are like a repository and from them force is drawn and the energies apply to the higher of the pairs of opposites. So we oftentimes speak in terms of soul energy and personality force. Now, you know, it's not invariably that way, but force is kind of a directed canalization of energy. Of course, there is the Shambhala energy and the Shambhala force. And when we have these Shambhala impacts, the energy of Shambhala is drawn upon and directed in time and space as a particular force to be applied. So DK is not rigorous in force and energy, but he does make that kind of distinction in general. Let's see what we have here. And I think you said 583. Okay, and let's see, where are we here, Catherine? Right, forces, right. Again, this is clear from the law, the fifth law, because we have, again, energies and forces. The forces are lower, and they are in an internecine warfare, and the frictional battle between them produce all disease, all ills, and bodily pain, which seek reliefs in death. So we have two energies, and they generally have to do with the periodical vehicles, monad and soul. The two, the five, and thus the seven, plus that which they produce, possess the secret. And this is the fifth law of healing. Now let's see. So in general, I would say that, as I'm not exactly sure here where to look in terms of what you want to discuss, and I don't want to read the entire paragraph. Let's just see if I can do this. Otherwise, it'll take too much time. Force. Okay, no, it's not going to be able to be done. I can't do it. So if you want to have a specific sentence or paragraph, then cut out or that particular sentence or paragraph or, you know, that particular section, and let's get directed to it, and then we'll be able to see. Yep.
Catherine Michael. Wrote, sorry, look right before page 584.
Okay, 584. Right before 584. Okay, the main point to bear in mind is that this rule relates entirely to the physical plane, dense and etheric, and to the effects which the conflict between energies and forces, yes, produced within the physical body. The forces are those energies which are limited and imprisoned within a form of any kind, a plane, an organ, a center. The energies are those streams of directed energy which make, this is another way of doing it, which make impact upon the imprisoned forces. Really, it's high and it's low, and the energies are the more influential factors, and we have to learn how to work with the energies and not simply be the victims of contained forces. So we work from the subtler planes where the energies are found, thus making contact with a grosser vibratory force. Okay, that's the general idea. And he, you know, there's some distinction here and there, some differences in the way he describes things. An energy is subtler and more potent than the force upon which it makes impact or establishes contact. The force is less potent, but it is anchored. And in these two words, you have the key to the problem of the relationship of energy. So, yes, this is a good section, and it gives us the basic idea. Now, right now, our task is to work particularly with soul energy and to work upon the contained personality forces, which may be conditioned rightly or wrongly, but the impact of the energies upon the forces will give us that kind of arrangement of the forces, which will be much healthier. I can't do too much more in general, because he always changes the way he works and how he describes things. But I think this is a good section about the subtlety and the potency of these two. But, you know, remember that when we're dealing with the Shambhala impacts, he talks both in terms of energy and force, so there's no cut and dried way of approaching these things. Basically, a compilation should be made. I don't know if we have one, but if you'd like to undertake something like that, it probably would be a good way to proceed and help bring clarity to yourself and others. Thank you, Catherine. Is there anything else? Anything else?
I think if you touch again on the importance of identification, mm-hmm. going back to mm-hmm. the paragraph in Glamour Book, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the entire problem can be solved.
Well, here it is. You know, here it is. And of course, identification is a trap, and identification is a means of release. It all depends what you identify with. And this is basically what the Buddha was trying to teach us. Are we identifying with the encapsulated energies, or have we set up a system whereby the higher and subtler energies can play upon these encapsulated forces, and rearrange them and bring them into right relation? But in order to do that, of course, we have to have these lines of connection with the higher, subtler realms. Now, in the beginning, you know, when we're studying with the Tibetans' work, basically we just deal with this one. This is our method of moving from a focused mind into the energies of the soul. And then he's going to teach us, he teaches us something about the Antahkarana building. And we use these words of power, and we touch into the spiritual triad. So again, we've opened up a new door for still higher energies. They are relative terms, because think about it. What was once called an energy, when we move higher, can be called a force. Because, you know, the higher point of view is going to be brought into relationship with these former energies, which are held and still have to be rearranged. The third way of reaching into the spiritual triad is, once we have real identification and soul infusion, we can begin to move from the second and third levels of the higher mind into the abstract mind. And this is often done through philosophy and reasoning and just opening up the intuition. It's not the method that DK has taught us. It is a method I use very frequently, I find. And in one of these or other of these three methods, we're going to find ourselves reaching into a higher, subtler level, where what are to us energies can be brought into contact with what are to us forces. Okay. Is there anything else before we get into our meditation? Okay. And here's Anne Veronica. Please review the sum total of the energies of the soul, 5. Okay. I think you said about 5 different aggregations. Okay, well, here's how we can do it, Anne Veronica. The energies, or forces, depending on the perspective, of the knowledge petals, that's 1. The energies or forces of the love petals, that's 2. The energies or forces of the sacrifice petals, which relate more to the mental plane. Kind of interesting that you have to have the mental factor for real sacrifice in the way DK is conceiving it, can be operative. So that's the 3rd aggregation of energies. There are many different ways to count. Now you look at all the synthesis petals. There are 3 of them, and they spring open just before the 4th initiation can be taken. from the time the first initiation is taken, they begin to open. And then slowly and in an overlapping manner, they're opening until they burst open. That's the Tibetan's word for it. Before the fourth initiation, revealing the jewel in the lotus. And this is the great powerhouse and representative of the monad within the egoic lotus. That makes the fifth aggregation of forces. There are seven forces here in the jewel in the lotus, and sometimes, or energies, you know. Sometimes we say that there are eight radiations and seven forces. It's kind of interesting, but seven or eight, and three here in the synthesis, three for sacrifice, three for love, three for knowledge. And we can count these up if we wish. So we basically have a 9, 12, and there's all different ways to count, 9, 12, and 7, which is, we have 9, and now that makes 12, and 7 is 21. Then you count the whole thing together, and you get the magical number 22. But I'm not saying that that's the only number that appears when you start counting in the jewel and the lotus. So, and in the general causal area, the general lotus area. So the different numbers count because, look, you know, you're going to have to do this as well. You're going to have to take 15 areas for knowledge petals because each one has three colors. You're going to have to take 9. It's going to be 9 areas for the knowledge petals, 12 areas for the love petals, and 15 for the sacrifice petals. Add those all together, plus the 3, plus the 7, and you'll get yet another number. So we can study the numerology of the egoic lotus, but as you said in your question, the basic number is 5. The 3 that are operative for knowledge, 3 for love, 3 for sacrifice, 3 for synthesis, and then there's the jewel in the lotus. And this is interesting because it makes sort of that ashramic number 13. 13 is symbolically, in a way, the Christ and his 12 disciples, with 3 disciples being of more importance to him than the others. So numerology, in the studying all these things, whether it's the head center or whether it's the egoic lotus, can be very revelatory of different functions within these areas. Okay, but 5 is good to go with, I think, you know, in the beginning, and then just go in there and start counting up and see what you arrive at, you know. Let's see, I'm trying to figure out right here, if you arrive at, I'm just going to count colors. 9 and 12 is 21, and 15 is 36, and add 3 more, that's 39. Add 7 more, that's 46, comes out like a 1. Does that mean something to us? See, that's what we would have to see. Why are there 5 opportunities for the sacrifice petals? Initiation is coming in. It's the fifth kingdom of nature. There's a big struggle in the love area. Why are there 4 opportunities for each petal? And, this is the area where we're torn back and forth. And why 3 opportunities for the petals of knowledge? So all of these can be answered in various ways. And you could, you know, write a whole article or even book on these things. As a matter of fact, I tried to do that, and in this video book on the egoic lotus, I try to deal with many of these questions. There's a lot of programming there, and maybe it will be useful to you. You can find it on Makara, and you can find it on YouTube as well. Okay, so what is the sum total? What is the greatest number of energies? Well, it depends on how we count the synthesis petals and how we count the jewel in the lotus. When it comes to the other petals, what we have is 9, 12 and 15, we have 36. It's going to sum to 9. It shows us a certain completeness in the number 9. So there are 36 energy areas. And that's very interesting because I think there are 36 decanates in the zodiacal wheel when we study each sign in a threefold manner. So the number 36 is important for the first 9 petals. And then how we count the others, it just depends. The synthesis petals are kind of whited out and they're not really explained to us very fully. And maybe he will do so in the next installment. Okay, Anne Veronica, that's what I can say about it for the moment. Okay, let's maybe we go on now and we have our meditation. And we'll be working on selfishness, you know. If we could only conquer that, it would be a major conquest in the world, a major conquest. So today's work will be with glamour of selfishness. It's a really bigger thing than any one glamour because it has to do with the glamour of personality per se. Okay. So we will reach out to each other in the silence. There's about 30 of us here, something like that. And in this silence, there'll be a kind of synthetic coming together. Now, since we're working in the area of what DK calls the greatest illusion, not using that word in a technical sense, we use the protective formula. And we make the this cross of divinity. So, as a soul, I work in light. And darkness cannot touch me. I take my stand within the light. I work. And from that point, I never move. When we trace the light and the lighted cross is before each one of us and before the group as a whole, and we sense its protective nature. Now we're going to blend the three lights. You know, by now you know the sequence. And we'll focus the dual light of matter from the etheric physical area and of mind, the lower mind. We will imaginatively bring these two lights together, the light of reason and the vital light of matter, blending on the plane of mind. So we can think clearly and with vitality. And then we bring in, we touch the light of the soul. We feel ourselves touching as if above the head, the light of the soul. And we bring that soul light down into the two other lights. We blend upon the plane of mind the three lights. Three lights are one light. Vitality supports thought, and soul vision supports thought. Three are one. And from this blended triple light, we will produce our beam of light, our searchlight, which is revelatory, and also our weapon upon the astral plane. So let us all say together, the light is one, and in that light shall we see light. This is the light that turns the darkness into day. And the Om three times. Om. Om. The light of day is a very interesting type of light. It's the light of Scorpio. It's the light that rules the Buddhic plane. It's the light that rules the hierarchy of human monads. So all of these lights will eventually reveal that infallible type of straight knowledge, that infallible type of perception, which is not arrived at simply by thinking, but by direct impression. Then, the formula. And as we are pronouncing this formula, we visualize the great searchlight being turned on, a group searchlight. The many little searchlights blend as one and create the group revelatory searchlight, which detects the glamour, and then it becomes a weapon and devitalizes or destroys the glamour. So we see that searchlight coming on as together we say, radiance are we, and power. We stand forever with our hands stretched out, linking the heavens and the earth, the inner world of meaning, and the subtle world of glamour. We reach into the light and bring it down to meet the need. We reach into the silent place and bring from thence the gift of understanding. Thus, with the light we work, and turn the darkness into day. And our searchlight is on. And it shines into the astral plane and can detect the place where glamour is found. And we can strengthen that beam. And that's our next section. Strengthen it with the spiritual will. Or maybe we should call it the spiritual willingness, because that really brings in the will. And we say, with power upon its beam, the light is focused on the goal. We're going to work with the glamour of selfishness. We'll call it that. It's really one of the glamours of personality, of course, and of egotism and of egoism. You know, they're all related to mistaken identity. And we think for a moment about what selfishness has done in our world over the many years. What has been the result in general of the selfishness of human beings and the human race? So there has been, of course, the vitiation, the withering of so many areas in the network of beings. People don't have what they need because others have too much. And the various kingdoms of nature are sacrificed, cannot play their role. And what's called the divine circulatory flow is disrupted. Now, with some idea then of the great disadvantages of the selfish way of life, which by now should be in process of being outlived, we will use these words of power with great assertions about how we overcome this glamour of selfishness. The power of our united light prevents the appearance of the glamour of selfishness. The power of our united light negates the quality of the glamour of selfishness from affecting humanity. The power of our united light destroys the life behind this glamour of selfishness. Now we'll go into 5 minutes of silence and we'll visualize the light penetrating the glamour and producing its weakening and dissipation. So 5 minutes of silence and intensity of purpose as we see this glamour of selfishness, sometimes so subtle, being overcome. 5 minutes. So we seek to overcome this very persistent orientation when we misidentify with the personality. And just question yourself, you know, to what extent do you, do I, do any of us identify as the personality and its tendencies and its desires? And to what extent do we give into that and not really realize that we are something much more interior than that? And we, you know, to live our life then in identification with that interior something, that interior consciousness, that interior being. So I dare say that for the rest of our lives and maybe some lives to come, you know, there are varieties of selfishness. Even the rich young man of the third initiation went sadly away when the Christ asked him to take all that he had much, sell it and give the money to the poor, and as the Christ said, follow me. So the rich young man went sadly away because some factor of selfishness, some lower desire, which was less of a desire than to serve the divine plan, something still had him in its grip. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, how far are we willing really to go? So we withdraw our light from off the astral plane, our beam. And it settles back into the three lights as one. And then these lights return to their place. And we sound the Om three times. Excuse me. Sound the Om three times, realizing that something has been done mentally, emotionally, especially etheric, physically, something of value to help clarify and make more translucent and eventually transparent the lower vehicles. Three times the Om, mental, emotional, physical. Okay, friends, next week we'll deal with that very interesting thing about the dweller and the angel at five initiations. Very interesting. And tonight, still in another, let's see, it'll be about 1 hour and a half from now, a little bit less, we have the keynote webinar for the second predecessory day in Gemini, and we'll be focusing on the hierarchical meaning of resurrection, and I hope that you have the I hope you have the link for that. And I'm not sure, Michael, do they have the link for that? For the
I put it in the chat box for tonight and tomorrow night as well.
Okay, and then tonight we still have another link. Let's see, where can we go with that? I wonder if I can very quickly, maybe I can do something here for this webinar starting at 8 o'clock GMT. Let's see if I can get at this a little bit. Sorry for the delay here. Here it is. So I'll put that in there for you. And if you want to join us for tonight, it's another webinar, and we'll be meditating on resurrection. And there it is. So if you want to just go in there, and I send it to all of you, if you want to copy that, then that will bring you to our next webinar in 1 hour and 20 minutes approximately. I want to thank you all for being here, and we still have more work to do tonight, and we will work accordingly. The three keynotes are so important: love, resurrection, and contact. Let's find out what resurrection really means, the resurrection of the human spirit and the resurrection of ourselves into the higher possibilities of initiation and helpfulness and usefulness. Then tomorrow, so far, the plan is to have the 5 p.m. GMT discussion of the soul of nations. There's a lot of interference going on with different nations trying to gain power over others. We'll have to look at cooperation rather than the attempt to establish hegemony. And then later in the night, 8 p.m. GMT, we will have the last of the three keynote webinars, which will be on contact as understood from the hierarchical sense. So at least we'll see some of you, I suppose, and as many as possible here in another hour and 20 minutes, according to this registration URL right there in your chat box, the most recent one entered. Okay, thank you, and lots of love and many blessings. We're reaching that, you know, Gemini is so important in all this teaching work that we do. And what DK gave us, being so identified with Gemini and Mercury. So let's keep on intensifying our point of tension as we move towards the actual full moon broadcast on Monday morning. Okay, see you soon, and bye-bye for now.